welcome to Season 3, Episode 7 of Professors in Rooms Getting Coffee with Drs. Justin Winzenberg and Stephen Jones. In this podcast, we look to explore truth, beauty, wisdom, and goodness at the intersection of faith and scholarship. Today, we are joined by artist Megan Yoder in the final installment of a three-part conversation about how art connects with the themes of beauty, truth, wisdom, and goodness. Today, we talk with Megan about Christian symbolism, the arts and church, and hope. But first, here are our highlights, lowlights, and insights for the week.
What are you drinking?
So I'm just in my very last cup of coffee for the day. So I'm drinking a little, I think I've mentioned our little machine here before from the Chibo Coffee Company that, makes a very nice, consistent little cup of coffee. Nice. And it has different settings. So you can choose, do you want a double coffee, which basically fills up a small coffee mug? Or I always do the half coffee, like the single cup of coffee, which only does half a mug. And then that way I can like spread it out through the day, you know, and then it's warmer when I have it. But
nice.
So, and you,
well, yeah, I've been getting in the bad habit. You know, we've already talked about how I have the gooseneck. Is that what it's called?
Yeah. The gooseneck, water heater.
Yeah. Okay. So we've already talked about how I have the gooseneck water heater that, here like
the,
to make
the
my
kettle,
own coffee.
Right, for making your own.
Yeah. Kettle. Yeah. Which they're not water heater, but yeah, the kettle, like, I've had the gooseneck kettle to make my own coffee here. But the problem is I had class at 8 o'clock in the morning on Tuesday, Thursday, last section of classes, which meant I did not have time to get here, make my own coffee. So what I found was there's so many coffee shops along the way between my house and Crown.
Yeah.
But all of them require kind of getting off the beaten path just a tad.
Just a little
bit.
It can
cause a headache. It can cause a headache when you're stuck at a light and you're kind of,
cause even
kind of tight on time.
The Starbucks there's a couple of Starbucks between your house and Crown, but both of them are not particularly easy to access when you're going direction, right? The one is easy to get to, but not to get out of, right?
Well, the one is right next to Minnetonka High School, which means if you hit it at the wrong time,
it's
got
line.
A line of high schoolers and high school parents that are just lined out the door. So that's just off the radar for me. Same with Dunn Brothers, which is actually off the road. But then I realized, so there is a Caribou Coffee right by Cub Foods in Chanhassen.
Okay.
And it's super easy to get out of, and then boom, you can jump right back on the highway. I'm not the biggest Caribou fan, but it, for convenience sake, I've been going there more frequently than I'd like to admit. And that's where I went this morning because I was kind of rushing in again.
Nice.
To work, even though they're called blended cold press, I think.
Okay.
Which is interesting. I don't know what it is. I'm sorry. Some of our listeners might know better, but it's like a cold brew with, I don't know if they put a powder or something in it and they blend it, but it's kind of creamy a little bit. Right. Like it's not just half and half.
Is it good?
Yeah.
So it's sweet or?
Yeah. I mean, you can get flavor shots in it, which I usually do. So I don't know if it's naturally sweet.
What flavors do you go with?
Vanilla usually.
Okay. All right.
Yep. But I do realize, I have a friend who he exclusively drinks cold coffee. And so whenever I'm hanging out with him, I always end up just kind of defaulting toward a cold brew, which is a little bit counterintuitive when it's,
what's the temperature there? Out. 5 degrees Fahrenheit.
No, it's not 5 degrees. Today it's supposed to be 53 degrees Fahrenheit.
Come on.
And on Sunday, 62 Fahrenheit.
Weren't you worried about snow yesterday?
There was snow yesterday.
Okay. All right.
Isn't that the funny thing? So there will be no more snow by the end of this week. That's what I think.
Gotcha.
But you're familiar with this stuff.
I'm familiar with it. It's Minnesota definitely weather. Different than what I'm living right now, but yeah.
Now think about this. This is off topic. I don't know. This has got to fit in somewhere with highlight, low light, and insight. But do you remember the feeling of, you know, a winter of bad weather, and then it kind of starts to creep up, and then all of a sudden, out of nowhere, 60 degrees.
Yeah,
it's like, I tell you what, everyone's mindset changes. It's like, oh, everybody's happy.
Right.
Everybody's feeling like, yeah, here we go.
So. It was different for me though, because I had, when we got those first couple of warm days, there was the way that our driveway drained. I had to like be careful to go out and cut a channel for the melting ice because the,
or you get water in your house.
Yeah, exactly. And it, I mean, it was never a big problem, but it's just it's an inconvenience So I was always out there chipping a path for the ice to melt. Yeah. It almost feels unreal now at this point. Cause we had a couple of light snows this winter and then it's been almost nothing. Even we've hardly had any rain in the last little while here. And now it's been, the last couple of weeks have been really beautiful. Blue skies, comfortable temperatures, still cool enough that everybody's wearing jackets. Like you still need a jacket. It's, most mornings are around freezing this last week, but nothing like Minnesota. So what's a highlight for you this week?
Well, now that we're talking about this, it seems so lame for everybody, I think, because weather is a terrible highlight, but come on, 60 degree weather after being through a Minnesota winter, that is a highlight. But it is actually related to my real highlight, was that I got out of this place for a good 3 days to go down to Dallas, which was 75 degrees when I arrived, and in Minnesota it had been like 15 degrees.
That's a noticeable difference.
60 degree difference can really change your mindset. Not to mention that when you're on vacation in general, it usually ups the spirits, I think, sometimes because you just feel like, wow, I get to get a break for a bit. So I went to Dallas and I caught a Mavericks game. I went golfing and I had some really good food with a buddy of mine. And that was a good rest, especially after we finished up a set of classes. We'd had a lot of things going on for the Crown Honors program that I'd been involved with. And now I had a chance to rest for a week. Spring break, this spring break, almost more than any other, was so needed.
This is only your second spring break since finishing your PhD, right?
Yep, that's right. And last year, it was spent in Austin, Texas, eating the best barbecue I've ever had in my life, hands down.
Wow.
That was a pretty good spring break too. I'll admit that. It was a little longer trip. We went the whole family and some other friends and Franklin Barbecue in Austin, Texas, I think is their brisket is unbeatable.
Nice.
Anyhow, that's a highlight for me. How about for you?
I have two. One is that we have a friend that's been visiting.
Yeah.
And and actually you and I recorded with him yesterday. So we'll have some episodes from Marcus coming out later this year. But that's been really nice. He had lived with us a couple of times over the summer and had been a student of both of ours. I guess you had him in one class at one point.
Yeah.
And so I've known him since 2013, I guess. Wow, that's almost 10 years. Yeah, so it's been really nice. Been good to explore Berlin a little bit together and then fun to do some projects together. So that's been good. The other highlight for me today is so one of the things that Envision Berlin does is that we partner with other local organizations, and there's one that was working on a refugee response thing of sending needed supplies to Poland, where kind of a lot of the refugees, that's the very first stop for many. And so we're one of the drop-off locations for this other organization. We're just helping in kind of a small way with that. But just maybe within the last hour, some, I think, high school students that go to school across the street had seen the sign saying, that they could drop stuff off, and they dropped off a couple of old iPhones of theirs and some power banks, and it's super practical, right? I saw a quote today. I haven't stopped to check whether it was real or not, but it said it was from Mr. Rogers that, like, when bad things happen. So apparently this is from his show, and he said something about, when there's bad things happening and you're scared, that his mom would tell him, look for the helpers and that you can find encouragement in that. And so certainly to see, these high schoolers noticing and then taking action with what they had. It's encouraging to me.
Nice. That's great. That for some reason, as you're talking about Berlin and just things happening where you're at, it made me also think of another highlight, which is that I did book my hotel for Berlin when we're coming to visit, as well as our as well as our train ride up from the Deutsche Bahn.
Nice.
Right?
Yeah.
So we're excited. We've got everything booked. That's ready to great. Come and visit.
Yeah, we're excited about that too.
Yep. Now, what's a low light for you?
I mean, I think in some ways my low light and my insight maybe tie together. So maybe what are yours for? What's yours first?
Well, my low light is probably maybe even a little bit lighter. And that my low light is that also related to my highlight is that spring break is over. And as much as I love new classes starting up and engaging with new students, there's a certain pace. We've talked about academic calendar and things with our that we posted on Patreon. But there's a certain pace that begins to pick up that is just fairly intense.
Yeah.
And it's not a bad thing, but it isn't restful like spring break.
It's a great time of the year, but it really is a push, isn't it?
It is. So a little bit of a low light is being off break and being off the rest and being back into the groove. But that isn't actually a comment at all on, you know, not enjoying going back to class or anything like that.
Yeah,
but mostly just the pace that picks up.
Yeah, that is absolutely a thing. And then suddenly, and I think we've talked about this on the podcast before too, but like then suddenly it's over, which is such a weird feeling, you know, this run up to the end and then where'd everybody go? Well, what, do you know what your insight is?
Insight. Well, we just covered a lot of insight and potential Patreon material.
I could do my low light and insight.
Yeah.
Together
why don't you do your, what's your low light and your insight?
Yeah. So I think I'm just going to put them together cause I don't know how else to deal with them. So the low light part of it has been, I have just really, I feel a little whiny even saying this, but like the thinking about the war has just really been hard for me. And again, I feel whiny because I'm like, I'm living in this place with beautiful weather and, you know, like, but the reality of the things is hitting me very hard a lot. You know, we're 3 weeks in now, since the big invasion of Ukraine. And I just find myself really, really struggling with that. And this is where it maybe moves to the insight, part of where I realize, so some of it is kind of this empathetic awareness of the suffering of others, right? And that I think is a legitimate expression of not being okay, you know? But I think there's also this other piece that I've realized, which is that, so the news from this conflict, some of it is encouraging in some ways, but then there's this thread where it's like, wow, that is so evil. And then the next day, wow, that's even more evil. And then the next day, wow, that's even more evil. And it's like, how far can this go? And then, you know, from human history, it can go quite far.
Yeah.
And I think what it is showing me is how much I feel so powerless to stop it, you know? And so I feel so, and kind of in this unhealthy way, then I'm very self-focused, about my impotence to stop this, and my inability to stop this great evil. And so, you know, I mean, there are things that I have done to try to engage it through prayer and even through some fasting and things where I felt led to engage in those ways and to ask God, even sometimes for some very specific things. And yet, you know, even my ability to sustain that is limited. And I think, so there's this growing awareness in me that part of why I'm so affected by this is just realizing I'm so insignificant in some ways. And then this other thing, kind of another layer of that I realized this week is that I don't know what my responsibility is. Because I, you know, some of these areas were touched on in my doctoral studies as well as in my dissertation. And you know, so these are things that I have thought some about. And so then I think, okay, so as a doctor of philosophy, whatever, as a PhD and in a related area, do I have some responsibility? And I think I was telling Jenny, like, I know, so when somebody that I care about is sick physically, I don't feel the responsibility to try to make it better. You know, maybe to pray for them, certainly, but in terms of like, I'm not the one that's going to heal them. I'm not the one that's going to diagnose it. That's not my skill set. I don't have that. But then I think about this and I'm like, this is in my area in some ways. And so do I have a responsibility? And I haven't been confronted with that before, you know, and then I see other people who are also in fields related to mine, engaging some of these questions, and some of them it's like, okay, that's helpful. And some of them it's like, wow, you've really dehumanized everybody in your attempt to solve this. It's just like,
I've seen on Twitter, you know, some scholars, I don't know what field they're in. They could be in international studies or something like it, you know, posting something about, hey, we got this, you know, scholarly forum, come join it. You know, we're going to be discussing conflict in Ukraine. And this was happening like within days after Ukraine was invaded. And I kind of thought, and then there was some pushback.
I mean, I've been in the same room as some of these folks, you know, and I've,
And there's been some pushback, I think.
Yeah. And it's just like, this isn't a game, you know?
Yeah. Not the time. And I think I saw a post of somebody saying like, I never really understood how easily academics can like segregate themselves from reality until they turned my life into an academic exercise.
This is
somebody posting right after the invasion of Ukraine. And I thought, I think that is a danger of saying, hey, let's get all the minds together and let's have a forum on Ukraine. Let's have all the interculturalists solve it. You
know, well, interculturalists, probably international relations. Yeah.
Well, there you go. International relations.
Yeah.
But I feel like, and then there's an equal danger among theologians too.
Of course.
Let's theorize it. Let's talk about just war
theory. Sanitizes it in some ways, right? Like then you don't have to look at the pain. But the reality for me is, and again, I feel so selfish in the way that I'm processing some of this stuff, but like the reality for me is it's not just that there are people in my city that are protesting, which is definitely happening. And you know, it's not just that there are Ukraine flags everywhere, which is also happening. It's also that at one of the train stations that I go to pretty regularly, there are more than 10,000 people a day showing up as refugees from this conflict, right? So like, this is not theoretical. It's here. No. I think grappling with my own limitations, and then particularly doing that in a new area that I haven't done that before, is kind of the insight, such as it is. How about for you?
And I got me thinking quite a bit now about this, but I don't know. I'm thinking about the tension between feeling that helplessness and not knowing if there's much we can do, but then not wanting to be silent on the sideline when there are probably practical things that we can do, but that the feelings of helplessness can sort of paralyze us. And not just helplessness, but almost a sense of pessimism that we can't do anything to help the cause anyways. Mm-hmm. And I think that there's certainly a sense of what is one individual going to do to solve like a major conflict between nations that extend, you know, even into Europe and across, you know, other parts of the globe. But there's also a danger, I think, in feeling like, well, then what's the point?
Right.
And I do remember just we'd recently watched Selma in one of my classes, and we'd been talking about the civil rights movement, and there was always a danger, I think, even of many white folks in particular during that time period of just kind of saying, well, what can I do? Mm-hmm. And I think King especially had warned against that sentiment among white folks of this just sense of malaise of like, no, that's not my problem or something like that.
Like, and gosh, what a shame, but what can I do?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Like, oh yeah, I don't agree with our country's policies, but you know, who am I? You know, I'm not a politician. Like that kind of sentiment or something. And King really railed against that malaise from white folks that was hurting the cause.
Right.
And so I don't want to be a person who's hurting a cause because I just get a sense of pessimism.
Yeah.
But I also, especially being in the States at the moment, thinking about this conflict over in Europe, and on the edges of Europe, I'm thinking, man, there's it does feel difficult to try to understand what I could do as a person.
But I do think one of the things that I used to do is to try to help my students understand how this stuff works with the thought that at some point they either directly or indirectly are going to be in positions of making decisions. Whether that's as, you know, voters already, but some of them may move into policy jobs or advise policymakers, you know, who knows. And I think, one of the things I remember trying to do with my students was to say, hey, like, you need to take nuclear weapons seriously, because somehow I feel like my generation grew up with nuclear weapons as a punchline, and that's not a good position to make policy from.
We've moved on from that, right? Exactly. The Cold War's done.
And that's so
we don't need
inaccurate
to worry about that anymore.
You know, it's like, I mean, gosh, yeah. This last week there was an accidental missile firing, from India to Pakistan, mm-hmm. both of which are nuclear states. And like the reality of what that could have become is so horrifying, and it should be. Mm-hmm. And policymakers have to know that. And I think, so that's one thing that I think that we can do is to try to, like, within our respective fields, give people tools to make good decisions. I think, you know, gosh, the whole areas of Christian ethics, you know, how do we reason well? And what is goodness, you know, which is one of the themes we haven't really pushed into yet this season, but I think is going to be so important. I think also, though, and maybe even, you know, the conversation that comes later today with Megan, you know, talking about beauty and truth and reminders of what ought to be become even more important when we're so much faced with what oughtn't to be. And when to be able to bear witness to goodness and to beauty and to truth when we're faced with ugliness and lies, and we're faced, you know, and to say, no, I'm going to bear witness to something that is actually good, because that is a good thing to do, and to kind of to view that as, okay, it may not solve the problem that's happening today, but it matters to say that there's another choice.
Point.
So that's where I'm at right now. Sorry. I just totally steamrolled your,
insight. No, I didn't. Like I said, I didn't have a lot. It was more just raising a few questions. Mm. Unfortunately, I don't have a lot of insight at the moment today for some reason.
That's because the weather's warming up, and it's the second day after spring break. So,
and the second day of a new mod. So new classes and all that too. My brain's just all over the place.
Yeah. We'll be back in a moment with Megan Yoder and our conversation about Christian symbolism, the arts and artists in church, and hope. As always, you can find more at patreon.com/profsinrooms.
Do you think, now just thinking about art and ministry, do you think that our ministry can become too narrowly focused on, like, just verbally proclaiming the truth? Because what do you think art might give us access to in terms of knowing truth that other approaches maybe lack, and how that works in ministry? Because I feel like if we're looking for these beautiful moments too of God at work, sometimes our narrow ideas of what ministry is can hinder that, I think. I don't know. Do you have any thoughts about that?
I wonder if you can use art to get things started. Either to get a reaction, or to ask a question, or to work through an idea that would start a conversation about ministry, maybe with somebody who either was burned by church people or by somebody who'd never heard it before. And maybe that's a lot to take in. I think it's easy to talk Christianese and forget the very basics. And so sometimes bringing it back to art can help bring out the basic understanding and cause language to be a little bit different than the Christianese that maybe I'm used to hearing or used to speaking back in the Midwest in my comfy church. Yeah.
I think one of the things that when I was being trained for ministry, there was this approach that I kind of picked up on, I guess. I don't know, which basically said the most important truths can be reduced to words and it can be reduced to relatively few words and we could put them in this little pamphlet or something, you know. And if somebody just verbally assents to these, you know, short statements of truth, then we've really done our job. And I think that's not really true. But I think when we start trying to go the other way to look at truth more deeply, more expansively, that it gets a little bit scary.
Especially for Protestants. Because I think if we had some theology of like iconography, like they do in circles that may be different than the ones I usually run in, there's a sense that actually Jesus can be present in these actual like experiences with images. And we can sometimes get worried, I think, in Protestant circles that's sort of form of idolatry, but it also means that we probably become very reductionistic in how people experience God and experience truth, right, through these verbal things rather than being able to actually encounter God in art and in images. Because I'm wondering, even as you were speaking, Megan, about using art as a starting place, can art even be the end place? In other words, like, do we have to start with art to get them interested in conversation and then get to the truth business of proclaiming the gospel? Or can they actually encounter the gospel in art apart from verbal explanation? I don't know. I mean, I know in Protestant circles, our tendency is most definitely say, yeah, but you got to eventually get to the gospel message.
Right, to the words specifically.
To the words, to the words. Yeah. And it's kind of a similar, I guess, tension with the idea of like an evangelistic presentation versus social gospel, which in the past has been a big dispute. But it makes me, I feel like even as a Protestant, I'm just a little more optimistic with the idea of encountering God powerfully in images at times too. And some of it's just hearing experiences, even of friends and others who've experienced something powerful with God, even in watching a film or something like that. So I don't know. I feel like maybe is there room for that? Is that just dangerous?
I think there's something interesting when you say, can we put the word first and put the art at the end? I think that is really, it's really interesting to think about because my initial answer is, oh no, it's an opening conversation piece. It's to get the thing started. But you're right. Sometimes the whole point of the piece and the whole point of asking the questions, sometimes it completely goes a whole different direction. And then the word is left out. But then starting with the word and then seeing the way that the word can affect somebody is a lot like when you're talking about with the concentration camp and going and then having the art after. And being able to walk away with that piece afterwards that helps to describe. I really kind of like that as an idea.
There has to be some interaction between the two, right? Because like I can't imagine going to a concentration camp and mistakenly thinking, because you have no knowledge of what those are, you know, mistakenly thinking that you're going and you're visiting, I don't know, somebody's farm or something. Like you're not going to really, the experience and the images that you're seeing aren't going to resonate appropriately. And without having some sort of true understanding of where you're going. And but then there's something that goes beyond just, okay, now that you're at this spot, let us explain to you the history of everything that happened and verbalize it all. There's something about just, okay, now that you're there and you understand those basic concepts, now live in it. And then when you live in it, you're affected way differently and way more powerfully sometimes than you are with sitting through a class on the Holocaust, you know, for 8 weeks or something. So I don't know what's there, but it seems like there is that sort of interchange between truth and beauty and art and verbalization that it's like one doesn't have to be prior to the other always, but there is this relationship that you can't really get to this powerful experience with art sometimes without having a grasp of what's trying to be communicated. And yet I also think that if we just conceptualize it as maybe just a starting place, could we be missing something? If art is just the starting place, could we be missing something and thinking that the end result should just be some verbal proclamation? I don't know. I don't know the answer to it. I guess I'm just spitfiring here.
I don't either, but I go back to the creation story as you talk about that. And how did God begin his creation? Did he begin it with a visual, or did he begin it with word, or did he intermix, or, you know, like let's go back to the very, very beginning of what the idea of creating something for his glory, because truly as we create things, it really should be to his glory. That's our purpose in life, right? To glorify him in all that we do. And so how did it begin? How did he do it?
I really love the picture of that in, what is it? Is it the Magician's Nephew? From Lewis, of Aslan singing creation into being and the, and so there's this sense of something spoken in the sense that it's coming, you know, through the singing, but then this artistic embodiment of that. I don't know. I think that picture of it is very interesting. And of course we don't have a lot to go on from the Genesis 1 passage, but
right.
Yeah, I think the,
Interesting. Wow, that's such an interesting picture. I've never gotten that far into the Chronicles of Narnia.
What book
is that even? I don't know. Yeah, it's the first book.
It's like the prequel, right?
The actual first book.
I never grew up actually reading those, and still wasn't until the movies came out that I'm like, I better take a look at it. And I just opened Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe and started there. But shows you how misled I was. But
well, I think that was the first powerful one.
Image.
And then the Magician's Nephew was the second chronological first one.
Makes sense. Yeah, makes sense. But what an interesting portrait or picture. And I think that's where that concept of truth and art and beauty all intersect in some ways, is you get the verbal word with, I mean, we all know the difference between just saying a word and singing it, and like, and how that can really do something that is, look at how good I'm at describing. This is probably why my own writing isn't so inspiring. Just sing it. There you go.
You could have a new gig as the singing professor.
There we go. Then students don't write papers. They'll sing their paragraphs.
Wouldn't that be interesting?
It would be. Yeah. I think it's a really interesting picture on creation.
On that though, the other day we were in a prayer time and I don't remember what it was, but so Jenny and I came in, we have this, three times a week, this kind of liturgical prayer time. And Jenny and I came into it a mess. We were late and it's just whatever. And we got to, there's a part of that where there's a reading from the Psalms and then the Old Testament, the New Testament. And the reading that was from the Psalms, one of the guys who was participating knew a song with the words of the Psalm and sang it just a cappella. And it absolutely removed Jenny and I from the mess that we were in and brought us into interaction with the words in a way that just reading it for sure would not have done. And there was something about the truth sung that did communicate to us. And I don't know. I think there is something about, and if he had sung la, la, la with the same melody, it wouldn't have had the same, communication either. There is something about that truth and this artistic communication of truth. Yeah. I don't know. There's something there. I do want to ask, one of the things that I have observed, and I know, so our group Envision Berlin exists to work partly with artists and creatives. And one of the things that we have noticed is when the church in the US interacts with artists and creatives, that there can be kind of this sense of, I guess using. So either kind of dismissing and saying, well, that's not really what we do here, which maybe goes back to that question of, you know, whether it's verbal or whatnot, or kind of using, but not really letting the art speak, if that makes sense. Is that something you've observed? Is that a real thing?
I think so. I think there can be cliche art, and I think there can be the comfortable from a distance art that can be more of a tool versus a useful tool. Mm-hmm. I think when you develop relationships with artists and you truly develop that, the deeper relationship, the more intimate relationship, I think then the artist will probably be more likely to open up. And then once they open up, then there's room for them to glorify God. And once they're glorifying God, then, oh, wow, this is an amazing opportunity to be able to share the Lord with others through art. But when it's that forced and
almost extractive. That, like, in a way, if the goal of art is to communicate something, right, of worth, of significance, and if you're saying, well, it can only go within these narrow parameters, then you're really not. I mean, then it sounds like maybe there's even, for one reason or another, I mean, it kind of goes back to what you were saying before, Justin. It's almost like there's a commitment to the parameters instead of a commitment to the truth, because the truth might come out more uncomfortably, like the painting that didn't hang on your wall for 20 years, right?
Right, right.
And that doesn't make it less true. It's just, it doesn't fit the...
And it might not be predictable.
Yeah.
And that's a little scary too, if it might not be predictable, because depending on the setting, it might make people a little bit uncomfortable, and not in the good way.
Yeah, uncomfortable.
Maybe in the good way.
I remember I have a mentor back in the day who came from a Roman Catholic context growing up, and then moved into evangelicalism, and he always just shook his head a bit at crucifixes, you know. In his claim was, you know, well he's not on the cross anymore, so why leave him up there? And yet, when I think about when I walk into a Roman Catholic mass, is that, like, there's something powerful and uncomfortable about reflecting on Christ on the cross, as equally as there's something powerful reflecting on the cross that's empty, you know. And sadly, why not have them next to each other? Like, so I get a little frustrated when our conceptualization of art is so, like, rigidly locked into doctrine or something like that, that, well, no, we don't believe Jesus on the cross anymore. He came off, he raised from the dead. Yeah. Amen. We get it. But, like, come on. Well, there's something powerful and potent on reflecting on all of those uncomfortable experiences, and why not allow art to, you know, God forbid someone were to create artwork from some of those stories in the Old Testament that would be brutally uncomfortable, you know, but yet could provide this potent expression in a way that could really land and really get us to reflect on the stories. And again, not just as a tool to the truth, but also in an expression itself of encountering God in those stories. I don't know. I'm not good at art, so I don't always know how that can be accomplished, but I do think there's some room there for art to express things uncomfortably and unexpectedly, and I wish we had a little more of it, especially in communities often deemed or labeled evangelical.
I agree. The idea of having just Christ on the cross being crucified in front of you, I understand the reverence with that. And I understand the symbolism with that and how powerful that is. But I wonder too, if we got a little more creative in our church settings, if we change that, because I wonder sometimes if we've become immune to that symbol. You know, what if we instead had a picture of the look that he gave Peter when the rooster, right? And if I had to sit there and look at that, I would be like, oh.
Yep.
You know, like,
yes,
I think I would be down on my knees a little bit more, because I've just been so used to seeing Christ on the cross. And that is powerful. And I'm not in any way, shape, or form saying that that is not a powerful image. But I think it can be safe a little bit too, because we've seen it so much.
Yep. Yeah, I totally agree. It couldn't there be ways to subvert that image though, too, in ways that are not offensive, but there's been all this work done on what a Roman cross would have looked like. And, yeah. and a lot of scholars are saying it was an X. It wasn't a T.
Yeah.
Put Christ on an X and all of a sudden, like, yeah, we're immune to the Christ on the cross. That's our T. That's such a common symbol. Throw him on an X and he's crucified and all of a sudden it might catch your eye very differently. Mm-hmm. You know, isn't that interesting? So the ways that art has the capacity to subvert some of the traditional images that pull us out of the malaise of, mm-hmm. of familiarity, and then can take us though to that same scene, but from a much different angle. But I totally agree. I mean, something like a look of Christ, given towards Peter or even some imaginative expression of Peter, waking up on the morning after the crucifixion. How does he have to live with that? You know, just the capacity imaginatively to do that. And I think sometimes in the classroom, in our best classes, what we can do is to try to get students to imagine some of that as well. But man, if we had artistic capacities to draw some of that out, I know my Gospel of John class, we looked at a bunch of different images of the raising of Lazarus that came through Rembrandt and all sorts of others that have worked in that in the history of art. And students the kinds of things it can convey that students aren't even thinking about when reading the text is, I think, so fascinating. So art can also be used as a conversation piece toward truth, like towards things that maybe the text omits or that the text is brief on that can then be illuminated. I love that.
And that's, yeah, I think even a couple of times I've prayed through the Stations of the Cross. And you know, the different representations of the passion narrative and walking through the different steps of that, and you know, different at different places, the Stations of the Cross are represented in different ways. And so the artistic communication of what was this, this, yeah, pressing more deeply into that. Yeah, I think there's really something there. But there is something though that if we require it to be safe and say, then we're requiring it really to not affect us except in very controlled ways. And that seems like in that way, it's actually not a commitment to truth.
I mean, I had a powerful experience once where my buddies and I were, we graduated from Crown and we were living together in an apartment, and we were watching some history program on Jesus and the disciples. And all of a sudden, like, we're not really paying that much attention. One of my buddies goes, "Hey," he's like, "which one of those dudes is Jesus?" And we'd realize that like this recreated History Channel, like had a bunch of Middle Eastern guys that were indistinguishable from each other in terms of it being Jesus or Peter or Judas. And it was one of the most powerful experiences of like, I couldn't tell you who Jesus was unless they focused in on this character, like during some of the explanations. And then it made you think like, okay, you want to subvert that standard image of Christ on the cross, you know, put him on X, sure. Or put a guy up there that we don't recognize, you know? So it's just so fascinating to think about how capable art is in drawing out our assumptions and drawing out our, like, especially with familiar stories. So I don't know, that'd be such an interesting exercise. I couldn't believe when I saw that, I was just kind of startled by it. Cause I'm like, usually, you know exactly who Jesus is the minute he appears on the screen in any Jesus film and I loved it in some ways. Cause I was like, duh, like it said something about Jesus that I hadn't reflected on before, which is what I recognize. And if I took a time machine back in time, would I be able to pick him out of a crowd?
Well, and I think we experience, art and truth with that differently in a crowd, in a community, than by ourselves. The impact of the different artwork when you're sitting there and if it's really hitting you hard, are you looking around going, am I the only one feeling this way? Or are you talking to me? Is it me? No, it's him or me, you know? And so, I think it's interesting how the impact can be different at different. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
As we get ready to go, one of the things that we like to ask guests on the podcast is just, what gives you hope?
Knowing that God is always there and will never leave me and will never forsake me and always loves me. Since the beginning of time, that's the biggest thing that gives me hope. That's the biggest thing that gets me up in the morning. And that just, it goes all the way back to my story of finally surrendering. He was the only thing left and he wasn't going anywhere. And so I think that continues to give me hope when it seems that everything else is falling away, he's still there and it's something I can cling to. Yeah. Although now I want to ask, what gives you hope? Do you guys ever answer that question? Do people turn it back around on you?
No, nobody ever has.
Oh, I'm turning it back around. Ha ha, they're quiet now.
We were prepared to ask the question. I think for me, one of the things that gives me hope and it connects to what we've been talking about is, there's something particularly beautiful about the gospel in the way that pain is redeemed. And I think there's something, we're living, here in a place where pain has deep roots, And I think the possibility of redemption and of new life and something not rewriting history, not causing it to be something other than it was, but to find somehow beauty that is greater than the pain, if that's possible. And I think it is in the gospel, and that gives me hope. And that's something that I think words really struggle with communicating adequately.
Yeah, for me, I think of hope maybe as a little H, which is, there's two hopes. There's a capital H and a small H. And the small H for me, family, my kids, friends. I mean, those things are things that do give me hope in the midst of struggles and in the midst of all the things that clash in our world. But in terms of the big hope with a capital H, it's going to sound cliche, but I really, really believe it. And that be the resurrection is for me something that pops out because all of the bankrupt sort of views that are floating around about heaven that we're supposed to convince ourselves is a good thing, even though deep down we look at it and we're like, that doesn't sound like too great of a place, it is completely challenged and subverted in resurrection. Because I think, again, I rest on this promise that the end of time isn't about just souls floating around with God, but it's about God resurrecting our dead bodies and recreating the heavens and earth and bringing them together. That's hope. Because to me, all the things that we really deep down love about this world are not done away with in the next life, but are actually, I think, illuminated and escalated in the new heavens and new earth through the resurrection. So it really is a resurrection, Christ's resurrection, but also the promise of our own resurrection, so that death doesn't have the final say and that we live in existence with God and with others on a new heaven and new earth. I love that idea. That is actually exciting thought for me, more than just singing a bunch of eternal songs in this sort of vague, cloudy existence, which is usually how we talk about heaven. So that theologically for me does give me hope.
Thank you.
But I say, you really want to weird people out, tell your friends and family members that you believe your dead body is going to have new life breathed into it and that you'll live a bodily existence on a new heavens and new earth, and that'll really freak them out.
It did bring up right back to the beginning about the idea of beauty and worth and what's going to be beautiful in heaven is totally different than what we can even talk about here. What's beautiful.
Yeah.
That idea of beauty is so different. And so
at the same time though, might these expressions of beauty on this side of eternity be kind of just glimpses of an even better beauty, not in a completely different, although of course we could say there are things that are beautiful on this side of eternity that might not quite be called beautiful in eternity, but could those things we really think are true and beautiful and good and okay, wait, I almost had all of them in wise.
And wise.
There we go. The four themes, Stephen, that those things that are that on this side are really reflecting even better. Mm-hmm. And then some that heaven isn't going to be just a surprise. It is going to be like a magnificent delight.
Yes.
Right. Hey, I should write a book, Magnificent Delight, you know, there you go.
Look at you. You're taking off. You're becoming quite a writer now.
I don't know. I've got a title and that's it.
Hey, that's the rest of it's going to be
mundane, it's boring, hogwash.
That's funny.
Well, you guys, this has been great. I have to go now here. I got to head down to class, but so I apologize. I have to abruptly leave, but Megan, thanks so much for joining us today. This has been great. I really appreciate the conversation and getting us to help us reflect on some of these key themes and blessings in your ministry in Berlin. It sounds like you guys got some great things you're participating in. It's really nice to meet you.
It was nice to meet you. Thank you so much.
Yep. Yeah.
Thank you. This brings the final part of our conversation with Megan to a close. In our next series, we'll dig more into Justin's dissertation. Thank you for joining us for today's episode of Professors in Rooms Getting Coffee. Reed Peters is a recognized patron of the show. As always, you can join us at patreon.com/profsinrooms for more conversation bonus content. We hope you can join us for coffee again next time.